You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the...
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Val Lance Gaffreau. Val is an educator, professional actor, director, and the artistic director at the TCU and UNT Health Science Center School of Medicine. For the last decade, she has created innovative curriculum based in theater practice to help speakers connect more empathetically with their audiences. As artistic director, she leads the development of an innovative communication curriculum called the Compassionate Practice to fulfill the mission of the school to train physicians to become empathetic scholars. Prior to her arrival in Texas, Val was the founding improvisation program director at the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science, where her curriculum has been taught to over 15,000 undergrads, grad students, postdocs, faculty, senior researchers, business professionals, medical students, doctors, nurses, and Nobel Prize winners around the world. Val, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
All right, so we do a thing now with the podcast, since we're in a global pandemic and we're all recording from our homes, that we do a check-in. So, like, first of all, how are you and where are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm, you know, happily in New York with my family. New York, Long Island is not maybe the best place to be right now, but I'm...
Better than Queens.
Yeah, I guess Cuomo talking about Long Island being being like the wildfire coming for us was not the most comforting thing to hear this week, but, you know, I'm just grateful to be with my family. I would not... It'd be really hard for me to weather this solo, so...
Yeah, it's nice that people got to go home or, you know, be with their loved ones. I worry about all those people who are alone.
Me too. Yeah.
It is hard to improvise when you're by yourself.
Indeed. Yeah. We have many medical students who are alone, and that's tough at any age, but particularly when you're in school. So.
Yeah. All right. So you spent your life in the theater, and many people feel that getting to the position of artistic director is one of the peak roles in our industry. I don't imagine that you ever thought that you end up being an artistic director at a medical school.
No, I didn't. I'm humbled by it, honestly. I always wanted to be an artistic director. And I think I wanted to be that before I actually knew what that was.
Right. But were thinking New Haven or Goodman.
Sure. Yeah. One of those places. But, this is a really humbling role and, you know, certainly one that I am learning from every day. So I think the title is more about helping to facilitate a mission than it is, you know, doing plays or any of those other kinds of things. But although we did do a play this week with our medical students that was, it was awesome. We did it on Zoom, and it was written by a nurse, Suzanne Gordon. It's a wonderful play called Bedside Manners, and it's true stories and it was a cool experience, but yeah, that's
so talk to us about this program. I mean, this is just so fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. So you are, and I know you're not strictly using improvisation, you're using other kinds of theater games, right?
Right. Other kinds of theater and other disciplines actually mm-hmm. that are helping me to think differently about theater. But a little bit about the medical school. It's our dean, Stuart Flynn, is a revolutionary. He's an amazing guy. And his mission in thinking about the future of medicine and how artificial intelligence is going to really influence how doctors interact with patients going forward. His mission was to think of medicine in a very different way. It used to be, apparently, that medical knowledge changed something like every 7 years, and now it changes every 73 days.
Wow.
And I think we can see that playing out in the pandemic, right? I mean, mm-hmm. the way that this is going forward and doctors learning from each other, not in a but on the fly right now, which is humbling and kind of amazing. I think we need to all be grateful for that.
Yes.
But Stuart's mission was to think about a medical school in which physicians were trained to think not about where they're going to be in 4 years, but where they're going to be in a decade or two decades. And since we don't even know what medicine is going to look like in 4 years, how can we train for 10 or 20 years down the road? And so his mission was to train future physicians to be empathetic scholars so that they're lifelong learners. They're always thinking of what comes next and that they're really thinking from the perspective of what is it to be in the patient's shoes? What is it to be in my team member's shoes? Because those are things that are never going to go out of style.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, the more that technology takes over, which I think is something that we're all finding right now in this pandemic, sure. the more that technology takes over, the more that what we really need to get back to is the core of what it is to be a person and to behave in a compassionate way. So, so that's this amazing medical school. And I was invited to be part of this by my partner in crime for a decade, Yvonne Kaplan-Lipp, who is a former journalist and a pediatrician. And she's the assistant dean of our unit, which is called Narrative Reflection and Patient Communication. And so we are part of a team that is also... We have a director of narrative medicine, Lauren Mitchell, who came from the Columbia program, and my cohort member, Chase Cross, who has a background in theater and public health.
So, hey, Val.
Other and learning every day. And yeah.
I you are sort of cutting out a little bit, and I don't know if it's me or you.
Okay.
Why don't we stop our video? Because that might help.
Yeah, we'll both do sure.
that. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Do you need me to go back to any of that, or was that?
No, actually, you the place where it stopped was a natural stopping point. I'm just going to make a note on my thing. Okay. You ready?
I am ready.
All right. So it's interesting. I think tech. Is teaching us something about how we need to look at ourselves as humans, because what we figured out with tech is it's constantly being upgraded as we're getting more information. Well, mm-hmm. behavioral science, neuroscience, all these things are teaching us how human beings make sense or not of the world. What you appear to be doing is putting in those upgrades, you know, getting the knowledge that we don't communicate well, we don't often collaborate well for all these different reasons. And what human beings really need is practice in these areas. And that's certainly something I always refer to improvisation as human being practice. And I certainly think our medical professionals need that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And I think they need practice in certain areas, certainly in the areas of listening.
Yeah.
And and understanding what it is to be on the receiving end of difficult news. I'm standing in a place of, you know, great admiration and wonder for what they're navigating in this moment. And I think that has shed light for me on what what a day in the life of a physician can be. That's so different from what most of us navigate. There's certainly tools that I hope can be helpful on that journey. But also, I think part of the big thing that we're working on is an opportunity for them to be self-reflective and heal themselves. The PTSD and the suicide rates of physicians, the attrition rate is astronomical, and it's because of the difficulty of their lives and their work. And I hope that what I'm teaching is helpful, and I'm also learning a tremendous amount about what is and is not helpful in terms of timing and those kinds of things. How do we hear what we need to hear in the right moments that can actually help?
Right. We just talked to Jamil Zaki, who Stanford professor who wrote a book called The War on Kindness. And one of his chapters is when his youngest daughter, Alma, was born, she had a very serious medical issue. And they fixed her up and she got out, but he went back and studied the unit. And it's the whole chapter is all about the burnout and the fact that we don't give, basically we give the equivalent of like, you can walk it off to the medical professionals. You and I both share grief journeys that we've had in our families that I think is an interesting way to also, it very much connects our history and improvisation with stepping into this space. So can you talk a bit about your journey?
Yeah. I have a rough background with cancer in my family. My brother contracted a cancer in 1979 that nobody had ever seen before. And he was a midshipman at the United States Naval Academy, peak of health, 21-year-old guy. And he collapsed on a tennis, was admitted to the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, and he died in 3 weeks. And it was, just like this epic journey for all of our family. And I was 15 at the time, he was 21. So his death really informed my life in the hardest ways, obviously, but also really, I think maybe in the best ways, the most profound ways to think about time as something that can't be wasted and to think about people being the most important things and all of that. My mother also had an aggressive cancer. She was diagnosed with a cancer she didn't even know she had, and she died in 6 weeks. So cancer for my family has been like a firing squad. Right. And these rough reminders, friends who have died of AIDS in the 80s. I mean, we all know people with these, journeys in health that are impactful and important. And I guess I've had those experiences in my life really shape me and help me look at the world in ways that I wouldn't without those experiences. I wouldn't even think to look at things the way I do without that.
Right. And it's hard for me to imagine a 15-year-old going through that with an older brother and knowing what those kinds of relationships are like. And Anne and I were very lucky to, be trained in this field of improvisation, which became our lifeline during Nora's cancer journey. I mean, we were able to draw on everything from building ensembles of our caregiving unit to, seeing all obstacles as gifts and making mistakes work for you. And, and I think the biggest one was the playing the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in. This idea of like, don't think about how this might have happened or you could have stopped it. Don't think about the tragic end, even though, you know, we knew that that was probably coming. By staying present with Nora, with our medical professionals, I've talked about this before, there was meaning. We did not have a meaningless period of time. It was filled with great meaning. And that also meant it had purpose and significance. And I know that was true for Nora, because it was very true for us too.
Yeah, I'm just in awe that you were able to keep your head above water and even see that in the moment. I think I was able to see answers in retrospect, but in the moment, these were messy journeys on in my life. And I'm really in awe of what you and your wife have been able to do.
Mm-hmm. So I was doing a little research on you No, this is a good thing.
All right.
You wrote this article in Players Journal, and it's called Stop Surviving an Acting Manifesto. Okay. So I want to note that your husband is teaching acting in another room.
Yeah.
My wife is teaching a comedy lecture in our attic. Mm-hmm. And my son, who is a senior theater major at Skidmore, is finishing one of his acting classes downstairs. So we're all doing this thing.
Yeah.
You write in this article, quote, "We as educators have to stop selling survival. There are not enough acting jobs, period. There never have been, but there really aren't now. We all know it." I would say you could double, triple, quadruple that right now.
Yeah.
And this is not a manifesto for saying don't follow this art form, but it is a manifesto for thinking about the art form in a much more broad and impactful and vibrant way. And I want you to talk to us about making this sort of discovery and this twist that you are suggesting for, which I 100% agree with.
Yeah, you know, when I was at the Alda Center, I just found myself in these rooms that I felt like, how did I get here? You know, I'm like at NASA and I'm at the National Science, Foundation, and talking to these brilliant people, and they're listening to me, and I'm thinking like, wow, how did this happen? You know, this is crazy. And what I realized is, you know, that I had spent so much of my life prior to that moment sitting around waiting for the phone to ring. And that to me was, you know, maybe this goes back to my value of time because of my brother's death. But looking back on it, it just seemed like such a colossal waste of my time. And I really feel like theater training and improvisation takes us into a recognition of who we are as people that most other fields just don't have. They're not given the perspective to think about each other in the same way. And the value of that is huge and vast and really exciting. And I thought, wow, I should do a workshop or something, or, you know, I should share these ideas. But then when I would float them to, you know, theaters or theater practitioners, I was met with such resistance, almost as though if we think about it any differently, it's going to topple the whole thing, right? It's a fragile place that we're in right now. Mm. We need to justify our own existence. And I think of it exactly the opposite. I think this can justify the existence of this kind of training, the value of it, the importance of it. And instead, it's looked at like, oh, well, you sold out, or oh, you didn't make it, or all of these negative connotations. When I think that, you know, some of the most talented people that I know, I just wish their voices were heard in places where we all need this perspective of our humanness. I mean, can you imagine if more of these voices were present in thinking about education or politics or religion or right? So it's a manifesto to encourage expansion, not to dissuade anyone from this field or this discipline.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we don't expect every English major who doesn't become a poet is not a failure.
Right.
And I think it's a limitation of thinking, frankly, about how expansive the work is, as you're suggesting. Yeah. And I know this, since my wife put together the first ever BA in writing and performance and comedy in the country, and she got to do that, I don't know, it's like 6, 7, 8 years ago. You know, she, when she was doing that, was very specifically thinking, you know, you don't, this field, I'm going to offer you a lot of information and a lot of skills building, but I'm not going to tell you you're going to become a stand-up comic or an improv comic, or because basically what you need to do is be able to do it all. You know, you are a writer, you are a performer, you are an experimenter, you are a creative, because we don't know what formats and the world is going to present to us. And especially right now, you know, I mean, we don't know when theaters will open. We really don't. And so one thing I'm enjoying right now is just the massive amount of inventiveness that our artists are bringing to keep us entertained while we're all inside. Whether it's mini concerts or John Krasinski's weekly talk show, just these wonderful acts of spontaneous art, that we're being, you know, privy to, and what would we do without it? If the pandemic has taught us nothing, it's the importance of artists.
I totally agree.
Let's dig in a little bit to I'd like to know a little bit of the curriculum of the program. You say that the curriculum team believes to be able to do both allows a doctor to find a story, then be able to respond and connect with a patient. So I imagine storytelling is something that's probably in there.
It is, yeah. You know, our curriculum is largely embedded in the clinical skills course. Mm-hmm. And clinical skills is where a medical student learns a clinical practice, and then they go in and they'll practice working with actors who are in the role of something called a standardized patient. And so what we're there to help support is that process of communication, so that rather than just going in and practicing with a standardized patient and getting a little bit of feedback on the clinical side, we're also providing support before they go in to work with a standardized patient, to think about listening, to think about observation, mm-hmm. to think about the roots of the story. And then we give feedback afterwards, almost as you would in giving feedback on a scene or something like that. So that it's not just the clinical side that's getting feedback, but it's also on communication and skill building there. So, it's our curriculum varies based on what they're learning clinically, mm-hmm. and we're trying to make it very integrated with. Kind of goes together. So coming up next week, for example, they're learning neuroscience, and they're thinking about stroke victims. And so we're putting together a module on fear and using, you know, some video from The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. I don't know if you know that film, but yep. Brilliant film that's all shot from the perspective of the stroke victim. Mm-hmm. And then we'll go through some exercises and they'll do some role play and they have an assignment to write a commitment statement about what they will do in their practice in light of fear. And it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. Like, what are you committing to, right? When you think about somebody being afraid and you're there to help lead them through that, what is an anchor that you can hold on to as a person to help yourself weather that? So I don't know if that gives you an example, but
it does. And the thing I think about too is the when I think about the very beginning improv classes we teach at Second City, and I think this is largely true with anyone who teaches Second City, that level A, that very first class, is literally all about eradicating the fear. That is like, you know, it is counting tiles in a wall. It is just take, like, you know, just stop thinking that everyone is watching you, because everyone actually is concerned about themselves.
Right.
And recognize that you have space to play and make mistakes and learn. But we just, you know, I know you know this from the work at the Alda Center too. You know, so many people, smart people, brilliant people, the greatest fear they have is speaking in public.
Oh my God.
It's like that it terrifies them more than war. I don't, you know, and I'm blessed with being an extrovert and coming from a family of extroverts, but we just know this largely to be true. So I imagine that that's the same for doctors and scientists and everyone.
Yeah. And frankly, actors. I mean, I am somebody who, as an actor, and I suffer from stage fright. so speaking in public for me is really, that's a challenge for me as well. It's much easier to hide behind a character or to be on stage with somebody else and sharing a moment and focus on that. But it, you know, it's a thing.
Mm. When did you first encounter Viola Spolin in those improv games?
Yeah. So I went to University of North Carolina School of the Arts, and Spolin was really foundational to the first of our educational process. And then it merged into Stanislavski but really the foundation of Spolin, I think, was important to do exactly what we all need, like you said, just getting out of our own way, becoming present, becoming curious, yes, and it's all of that stuff that we need. So that was my foundation. And honestly, when Alan invited me to participate at Alda Center, it had been a while since I had worked on Spolin. So it took some
revisiting,
some reminding to get back to those moments.
I want you to tell us a story, and you did this in a video I saw, about a third year medical student who waited for an hour to talk to you about the first time he had to break bad news to a patient.
Right. So this medical student came and found me after class. He had taken our workshop when he was a second year, and now he was a third year, and he had started to see patients. And he had this experience where he went into a room with a woman who was going to have to learn that her cancer was metastasized. And he had never been in a room like this before, so he was nervous about going in. But he didn't have to say anything. He's just a medical student, so he was there to primarily observe. And he said that, you know, they went in and the woman was there, and he said that the physician gave the news that that her cancer had metastasized to her liver and that she only had a couple of weeks to live. And he said the thing that struck him was that he saw that there was really no reaction. The woman didn't really respond. And so there was no questions or anything. So they were getting ready to leave the room. And he asked the physician if he could stay and speak with the woman there. And he was given permission to do this, which is quite rare, I guess. But he said, I went into the room and I sat down with her and we held hands. And he thought back to the mirror exercise about leading slowly and simply and then allowing somebody else to lead. And he said what happened was he just slowed down and he told her as simply as he could what was going on. He just slowly and simply what was going on. And he said, then he waited and she started to cry. And when she cried, it made him cry. And when he cried, then she had some questions to ask. Mm. And he said it was this perfect mirror with me leading and then her leading back and forth and back and forth. And he said ultimately he knew exactly where she was coming from. And it was just this moment where the work became a part of his life. It's these simple exercises that can have a profound impact in unexpected ways. I'm glad he was able to carry that forward and learn from it. It shaped her getting the information, but it also shaped him in the way that he thinks about medicine and the way that he thinks about people. So anyway, I love that story. It's profound to me.
It is to me too. And I think the reality is it's not that these conversations aren't going to be hard. They are going to be hard.
Yeah.
We're just learning to we have to push ourselves to have them.
Yeah.
And then sit in this place where we're okay with the discomfort. We're okay with the emotion. We're okay with the tragedy of it all. And this is the world we live in right now, which is so unsteady and uncertain. Oh, and I don't know if you saw that just today, the University of Michigan released an improvisational study that showed that people are 20 minutes of improvisation, I think it said, a day or a week makes them happier more able to deal with uncertainty.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I love the evolving nature of the study of this work. So I think, you know, the great thing about your work is you're putting it where people need it most. And I don't think people always think about improvisation as a tool in crisis, but it absolutely is the best tool to have in crisis.
Yeah.
All right. So we always end the interview with a yes and story, which this is like the total layup to give to you. So I present you with, give us a yes and story from your work or life.
Okay. Yeah. I have a life yes and story, and it was really like 12 years ago, but it's a story that I keep revisiting because I keep needing the reminder. So I had hit this this obstacle in my career, right? I was just like at a dead end, and everything was colossally unfair. And my first impulse in a situation that seems unjust is to just be mad. I just get pissed off. I mean, that is my go-to. And I had kind of lived in this place for a couple of months. I mean, I was mad. And I had a couple of friends from college, Eric Kedora and Jeff Rose, who really awesome guys. And they don't live in New York, but they happened to be visiting. And they said, let's just all get together in the city. So I took a train into the city and we went to this bar down in the Village, Bar 84, which is no longer open. But at that time, they had these rotating art exhibitions. And so as I walked in... I walk in this bar and my dear old friends are sitting underneath this art exhibition, which happens to be this massive, massive set of angel wings, literally hovering above their table. And I'm so pissed off at the time, I literally can't see the metaphor, but there it is, Jeff and Eric sitting under angel wings. And, you know, we spend this evening together and there's a lot of time of getting caught up on all sides, but I totally monopolized a good chunk of this time just explaining about how pissed off I was at the world. Mm. And they very patiently listened. I mean, they were there for me, just listening. And finally, I don't know what happened. There was some sort of a transition. And Jeff said, you know, you have to stop fighting the reality that you're in and you got to walk into it. And Jeff is sort of a very Buddhist kind of a philosophy in his life. And so he was coming at it from that lens. But really it's the exact same principle, right? Walk in, accept the truth of the scene that you're in, and then figure out how you can make it go forward. And there was something about that evening, and, you know, perhaps it was the wine, perhaps it was the great friendship, I don't know, but it was this transitional evening in my life. And I left, and over the course of the next couple of weeks, I was able to stop being pissed off and start being sad. And I had grieve and just let this go. And out of that process, I walked into my job at the Alda Center.
Wow.
Yes, and became a part of my daily existence, everything.
Wow.
And it was just like this transitional moment of my dear friends under angel wings, walking me through a transition that I desperately needed. And I keep coming back to that moment over and over again in my life because it changed the course of everything for me. So
a great yes and story.
I know. I love those boys.
Val Lanskifro, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Feel young.
Survive.